Wholesalers, welcome back to another edition of Wholesaler Masterminds Radio. Have you been out to iTunes? Maybe that's where you found this edition of Wholesaler Masterminds Radio. When you go out there next time, do us a favor, give us a rating, tell us what you think of Wholesaler Masterminds Radio. We're doing our best to deliver the best possible content to help you in your education to become not just a good wholesaler, but a great wholesaler. You know, a great wholesaler also needs to know the finer points of entertaining clients. Yes, that's certainly a part of what we do. And if you're like me, you're entertaining clients and you get that wine list in your hand and you're kind of wondering, am I going to make the right decision? What's the right way to navigate this? One of our most popular guests over the course of the last year and a half we've been doing Wholesaler Mastermind Radio has been a gentleman by the name of Michael Bryan. And Michael is the founder and executive director of the Atlanta Wine School. And I'll just read a couple of his credentials because they are lengthy and impressive. The Society of Wine Educators, the Court of Master Sommeliers, Wine Spirit Educational Trust of London, the Spanish Wine Academy, and there's always the one that's in French that Michael always has to pronounce for me because if I try to do it, I'll get in deep trouble. He's been the wine guy in Alton Brown's Good Eats, the Wall Street Journal, the Home Shopping Network, and, well, to make a long story short, he's back for a second appearance on Wholesaler Masterminds Radio. Michael, welcome back.
Rob, thanks. I tell you, you are full of energy as usual today. It's great to be back on the show.
Thank you so much. So we want to have a little conversation today about the quote-unquote socially accepted norms of wine pairing, that is to say, what food goes with what wine, and then kind of nibble around, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended, around what are some of the other kind of fun and interesting choices. But I think the most important thing, really, as I put myself in my entertaining spot, clients, me, wine list, 4.5, 5-star restaurant, I'm nervous, man. I don't want to screw this up. How do I attack this?
Well, listen, let's start off with using the resources that are available to us on the spot. And you just opened up the scene or the setting with a 4- or 5-star restaurant. So this is going to be a place, unsurprisingly, that staffs a talented sommelier, if not more than one. The Bellagio has 12 sommeliers.
Mm.
So these are the kind of establishments that need to have, due to the sheer amount of expensive wine inventory and spirit and craft beer that is already on site. Inventory, by the way, that they help shape and source and put there. They are really today's kind of culinary gods, if you will. I mean, these are the folks that have come to the forefront. 10 years ago, it was all about the chef, and there's still a lot about, you know, the chef and the chef and the chef. But now this other individual that's in the front of the house is really starting to kind of make a lot of waves and attention. In fact, there's a movie coming out this summer called Somme, and it's really going to focus on what it's like to be one of these flavor gods, these individuals who can break these liquids down into a matrix of flavors and overlay them into a meal.
Wow.
And so, and it's difficult work, and in many respects, they have talents that few chefs have. So their ability to work with the chef is really what completes your dining experience. So let's just walk through the steps real easily. I'm there as the host. I've got three guests that are joining me for a nice dinner that evening. If I haven't made proper plans or arrangements with a sommelier, and we know from our previous article that we wrote for you that we gave some tips on how to do that. I think we touched on that in the last show.
We did. Some good tips, I might add.
Yeah. So if we haven't gone to that extent and we're just kind of flat-footed, and which is fine, then, you know, one of our first engagements is going to be with the sommelier. And this is the individual who, if they're doing their job, they're going to find out sort of in general what's going to be in store for the meal that night, multi-course, main course. Do we have preferences for reds? Do we have whites? Do we like Old World? Do we like New World? And very important, they will have a subtle, if not more direct way, of sort of finding out what your budget is. And believe me, they're a lot more subtle than just saying, "So you got, you know, $100 to spend." I mean, they're not going to do that. A lot of times, they will point to something on the wine menu that, of course, only they and the host are looking at, and they would say, "You know, it's something like that, kind of along the lines of what you're thinking." And of course, they're pointing right at the price that says, let's say, for example, $155 a bottle.
See,
so that gives them immediate input on, hey, am I pushing it here, or am I in the zone?
So that's a really important tip right there, because all the wholesalers, of course, have some level of budget consideration when they're entertaining, as they should. And so it's not that they've kind of mistook where they were supposed to point. They're purposely pointing at that price to try to get some direction from you.
Yes, and in fact, it needs to be said, very important here, that wholesaler host is often tempted to do what they think is the very polite thing, particularly if they're not very confident in wine, and say, "I'm going to let my guests choose." You really don't want to open that door. Your guest can feel certainly a little awkward from that exercise. And if it's a 4 or 5 star restaurant, they're going to be thinking things like, well, is my choice going to be too cheap, or is my choice going to be too expensive? You know, I'm not sure really how much, you know, what I should do here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think that we're doing kind of a favor by turning over and going, you know, hey, well, you know, why don't you choose, Rob? But really, we should keep it in-house and just work with our sommelier. And they'll guide us, and they'll help us make the right decision, because, again, they know chef's menu, they know the cuisine, they know the flavors, and with just some minimal direction on color and price, they're going to put you in one of the best selections that can be made. And they're free. They don't cost any extra, and their job isn't to make you spend more. It really isn't.
We still will talk about the whole wine-food pairing, but there's also, as you started speaking, we're here talking about sommeliers, there's also a couple of things that I wonder about, and I'll bet some of our listeners wonder about too. You go to a beautiful high-end restaurant, and they bring you the bottle, and they show it to you, because they want to make sure that, you know, that is what you've ordered, and it represents the right year, the right vintage.
Mm-hmm.
And then they whisk the bottle away in some places. Yes, they whisk the bottle away. And they take it over to the opening/tasting table. How do I feel about that? How do I feel about the sommelier tasting my wine before I do?
I'm glad you brought that up. And there was a little bit of scuttlebutt printed about that last year, which I can't possibly find reason to believe in. I mean, these folks are employed with their all-star palates, their formidable knowledge of the wines, the producers, the areas, the vintage. I mean, they are just walking databanks of liquid knowledge. And, you know, because of their all-star palates, I should add, by the way, for the most part, I can say this about my colleagues, because I'm a somm as well, they really work to keep that sensory acuity sharp.
Mm.
So their treadmill, you know, while the rest of the free world is on a conference call at 10 a.m. on a Monday, they're sitting there tasting wines blind with other somms.
Yeah.
That's their practice, and that's something that I do as well. And so these guys are absolutely going to be able to ferret out the nuances and subtlety of how that wine is showing. Is it a little over the hill? Does it need a little bit of opening time, a.k.a. decanting? How long does it need a decanting? Is it flat off from oxidation or a chemical catastrophe from the cork called TCA, making it a.k.a. a corked wine? You know, these are all of the things that are going to be absolutely missed by so many people. And when you are investing in that amount per bottle, and what is perhaps a one-time opportunity or experience with your guests, you know, let's cover our bases. Let's make sure that the expert is going to taste it. We all know, we don't think about it, but we know that the chef is tasting our food and the sauce back there. Why should we be bothered that, you know, something that is more expensive than our dish is being tasted by an expert on the front of the house.
That's a great perspective. I appreciate that. All right, let's talk a little bit about this food wine pairing thing, and in the interest of what could certainly be an hour's worth of discussion, I want to really focus for a moment on some of the aha pairings. So, you know, for a lot of our listeners, there's the old school discussion of fish white, beef red. Can we just bust apart a few of those and just give some people the next time they go out to dinner a couple of less common pairing adventures?
Yeah. Well, and we've got to, like you said, we can feast on this for a lot of time because it is a fun topic. It's a real world topic. It's something that we all deal with, this enormous growing year-by-year consumption of wine. I got a flash email today just once again to say that consumer consumption was up again in 2011. And so, you know, this is a real challenge for Americans, as I like to remind all of my event guests and my students that I see, approximately, you know, 12 to 16,000 a year. We have the most difficult job in the world of putting together wine and cuisine. And when I say that, people are like, you know, okay, well, what do you mean by that? And how can it be the most difficult here? They forget that our melting pot culture has produced not just so many different ethnic and regional cuisine options, but of course, we didn't stop there. I mean, the global cuisine market has infused each of those with others. So, you know, to have California cuisine that's now infused with Asian flavors, et cetera, these are all distinct variations of what were known cuisines. And then overlaying that with, you know, if you're in a large market like D.C. or New York or Chicago or L.A., you've got 150,000 wines a year approximately to choose from. And so those are all different condiments to the meal or sauces that you drink that you want to attempt usually at incorporating in, you know, to the meal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's really two different schools of thought, okay? And these are very broad, but it's an easy way of sort of lumping people into one or two positions or one or two buckets. One is, I'm not going to say that one is better than the other. They're just two very different approaches. One is the approach that says, this is the wine that I like. I really enjoy drinking this wine. It gives me a lot of pleasure. That is what I'm going to drink. And what I eat with it is absolutely secondary in my mind. Okay?
Yes.
I sort of call that the power of the psychology of pleasure approach. Because, you know, we've made the decision that, for example, Napa Valley Cabernet at approximately $25 a bottle is what we want to roll with. It's what we enjoy drinking. And so if I end up having Chilean sea bass with that, well, you know, you go for it, man. If you like Chilean sea bass a lot and you like Napa Cab a lot, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. Now, that's sort of bucket number one, and there's a lot of people that roll with that. One, they roll with it because their desire to have those two things, albeit together, outweighs any sort of notion of, is this a correct pairing? Does this break a rule? Does this fall in any guidelines? They don't care about any of that. Or you could look at it this way. It's such an intimidating, complex area, they don't know what the correct solution is. And so, like a lot of people, through exasperation and overwhelmment, they just go, I'm not going to worry about it. I got to eat. I got to drink. I like this wine. I like this cuisine. I'm going to put them together.
And as long as they walk away satisfied and happy, all the better.
All the better. Yep. No problem. So that's the psychology of pleasure. Okay, bucket number two, this is the area that, you know, I tend to spend more time in because it's my field of endeavor. That is what I call the 1+1=3 bucket or position. This is where we are looking at texture, synergy, weight, body, and matching to have a synchronicity, a harmonious, togetherness in the mouth. And so that takes practice, that takes a little work, that takes knowledge. I alluded to, our earlier conversation about trial and error. And I'll give you a classic example of why this isn't easy to do. It's a lot of fun to try and do, but it's not easy to do. I was on one of my wine trips in 06. I was out in a vineyard house, as we often stay in the middle of the vineyard in the homes. This particular winery sent out their executive chef for myself and another colleague's dinner that evening. And, I found myself sitting there after a long day of tasting and visiting in the dining room with my friend, having some wine. And we said, what are we doing here? Let's go in the kitchen and talk with chef. And so we go in there. Now, understand, this executive chef is, formally educated, works for the winery, works with their wines on a daily basis. And we sat there and we watched him put together this pan-seared, wild-caught salmon with some seasonings that was going to be put atop some arugula. And it was amazing because I watched him play with the vinegar, the acids, the oils, the salts, to get this in a position where he liked it with a white, a red, a rosé. And it was somewhat of an epiphany for me because as an educator, I thought, this is stuff I'm just supposed to know. People assume I know it. It should just be intuitive to me. And as I watched this expert using wines that he knows backwards and forwards go through a trial and error on a fairly simple meal, fairly simple dish, that's when it hit me. This isn't an automatic. There's some things that over time will become somewhat intuitive that we can sort of stay within as guidelines. But each time we recreate a meal, there's a little bit of trial and error that's going to be involved in just getting this and playing with it, just getting it to, the right position that we want.
Before we wrap up, Michael, let me ask you, is there one, and I know this is a hard question, is there one all-weather wine that,
Yes.
Go. Yes. Tell me what it is.
Listen, I'm going to pick red, even though I love my more delicate white wines, but really we're in a red wine consumption dominant time of our American wine culture. So red is where we need to send people, and the people who drink wine are already going to know what I'm going to say. They're guessing it, and they're right. It's Pinot Noir, and in fact, I even mentioned this in the article. Of course, that people are going to see the Pinot Noir that I chose purposely is Oregon Pinot Noir. Now, we make great Pinot Noir in California, in Santa Barbara, Monterey, Carneros, Russian River Valley, Sonoma, Sonoma Valley, Sonoma Coast. But the Pinot Noir that has a little more acid and just this sort of nuance of earth tones that is added into the ripe red fruits is Oregon Pinot Noir. It's the kind of wine that can stand on its own. You can be out on the boat dock. You can be on the porch with the chiminea with friends or around the kitchen island, not even thinking about food. Or you can throw it into some great cuisine. Cuisine like fish. Yes, red wine with fish. My favorite with Oregon Pinot is a wild-caught salmon that has been cedar planked, and then you finish it with a little reduction of balsamic and cherry coke that you sort of boil down and drizzle some of that over the top.
Balsamic and cherry coke.
Yeah, real easy. I mean, who can't get their hands on that stuff? And it's not expensive balsamic, something from the grocery store. You don't want to use a tradizionale from Modena for this. Just something that comes in a big bottle, and you reduce that down until it is just about a syrup, and you drizzle it over. But you're putting that Pinot with that. Consequently, anything that comes from a pig, Pinot Noir loves, from your hams to your tenderloin roasts to your chops to bacon. Oh, my gosh, bacon. bacon and Pinot, pigs and Pinot. Yes, it's a great combination.
Michael, as always, so much appreciated. We ran a little long. It was worth every extra minute. Wholesalers, jump out to the website, link back to the Atlanta Wine School. Michael does event planning for you and your clients, so be sure to go back out to their revamp website and check out all the wonderful things that are going on at Atlanta Wine School. And then when you're done there, shoot over to I Carry the Bag magazine and subscribe, because Michael's going to be writing his second article, which will appear in our next edition. Michael, I can't thank you enough for taking time to educate our listeners.
Always a great time, Rob. Thank you as well.
Absolutely. Wholesalers, we'll talk to you again next time on Wholesaler Masterminds Radio.